It is Wednesday, September 30th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Sarah Williams in Washington. Coming up, fighting continues in the northern Afghan city of Kunduz as security forces battle the Taliban. U.S. authorities discuss whether a new U.S.-China cybersecurity agreement will have an impact on hacking. An analyst reacts.
It's going to take a lot of effort on both sides in many ways, of monitoring, of reaching out to the people who might actually be committing such acts.
And some Hollywood memorabilia hits the auction block. It's all ahead. Heavy fighting is continuing in northern Afghanistan as the country's security forces are trying to recapture the city of Kunduz from Taliban fighters. I'm joined now by reporter Ayaz Gul. Ayaz, currently, what is the situation like in Kunduz?
Well, it appears, even though the government has made claims that it has its security forces have made some advances since yesterday, but as of this moment, the Taliban seems to be firmly in control of the Kunduz city, and its fighters have surrounded the city airport, where reinforcements of Afghan security forces have landed 2 days ago, but they have not been able to come out of the airport because they are under attack from Taliban fighters. So they are unable to move towards the city. And then we see there were reinforcements that arrived in the neighboring Baghlan province from where they wanted to advance towards Kunduz. But then the Taliban fighters in small groups had already positioned themselves and mined roads. And as a result, Afghan security forces have not been able since yesterday to make any advances from that side of the Kunduz city. So it seems that the government, despite making certain claims and promises, has not been able to make any significant advances. And the Taliban, in the meantime, are consolidating their positions because they have captured a couple of districts in the neighboring Tahar province. And they have been able to maintain peace within the Kunduz city. So it's quite an embarrassing situation for President Ashraf Ghani's government in Kabul. And there was a very angry mood that was witnessed today in the parliament, which was in session. And they summoned top security officials to the session today to seek an explanation for this major failure that led to the collapse of Kunduz to the Taliban.
There are also apparently reports by people, you know, healthcare workers and people working for relief organizations. Apparently, they have been targeted, I guess, by the Taliban.
Yes, there were some pictures also circulated on social media, and even United Nations, in its latest statement today, also discussed those disturbing developments that people are being targeted by Taliban insurgents in the city. But the Taliban spokesman, Zabihullah Mujahid, has issued repeated statements over the last 24 hours denying those reports, saying that the situation, according to him, is calm and no such incident has taken place. And instead, the Taliban has announced certain phone numbers, telephone numbers for the people, those associated with aid organizations, to contact on those numbers in case they are finding any difficulties. But obviously, it is not possible to verify independently whether whatever the Taliban is saying is actually true. But yes, there have been a number of aid organizations that have already relocated from the city because of security concerns. I mean, shortly after the Taliban arrived in the city, and they have discussed these disturbing developments. But let me just tell you that Kunduz, situation in Kunduz have been volatile for the past few years, and especially in recent months, things have been very, very difficult in terms of the overall security situation there, because we have seen internal rivalries within the provincial administration, where the governor has been from the Pashtun ethnic community, whereas this police chief and other security officials represent the Tajik community. So that internal rivalry over the last few years has led to creation of certain power groups, armed power groups that are supporting one faction in the administration or the other. So they are also obviously in a position to take advantage of this volatile situation in Kunduz. So it is very difficult to really determine exactly who is responsible or behind those incidents of looting and, you know, robberies and even certain reports of, you know, rape that have been committed. So it's not possible because there's no aid organization currently present other than this Doctors Without Borders. They say their hospital has been treating scores of patients since the fighting broke out, and they are in a position to discuss exactly how many people have suffered, civilian casualties have happened, but obviously it is not possible to find out exact details about what is happening inside the city where Taliban fighters appear to be in full control.
Thank you very much, Ayaz. That's Ayaz Ghul reporting from Islamabad.
Thank you.
Well, joining me here in the studio is social media editor Andrew Palshevsky. So, Andrew, how is social media reacting to the fighting in Kunduz, Afghanistan?
Oh, well, there's still a lot of reaction, a lot of photos coming in from people sharing that on social media. So people are still very wary about the situation there and hoping it's resolved very soon. The other big story today on Twitter is Edward Snowden, one of the latest people to join Twitter, of course known for leaking information about U.S. surveillance activities. In just about 24 hours, he already has close to 1 million followers. But interestingly, he's only following one person, and that's the NSA's Twitter account. People also noting it's very interesting. His first tweet, he said, "Can you hear me now?" Now, that's the slogan for the U.S. company Verizon, which is a cell phone company. So they're saying it links back to his activities leaking the information about cell phone surveillance. That tweet already has 100,000 retweets and about 90,000 favorites just in the short period of time since he's tweeted that. So a huge, huge storm of activity over Snowden's joining Twitter. People calling from Twitter to ban him, but instead they verified his account and giving him some credence there. And the interesting thing, too, is that his description that he uses for his little bio, he said, "I used to work for the government, now I work for the public." So very interesting there. A lot of journalists starting to follow him, a lot of people who are very interested to see what he has to say, what he might do now that he's on this platform and has a really a global audience to reach out to people through social media. So we'll see what comes of that for sure.
Yeah.
Also, there's been making the rounds on Facebook this privacy notice that people have been posting. It says, "I do not give Facebook or any entities associated with Facebook permission to use my pictures, information, or posts, both past and future," and it goes on and on and on. This is a hoax that kind of comes around every few months where people say, "Oh, Facebook's going to charge, or they're going to use my photos and my information in campaigns and things. I don't want them to do that." Posting this notice, which a lot of people I've seen have been doing, really doesn't do anything. It doesn't subvert Facebook's terms of use. Those are kind of rock solid, and posting this in your status doesn't do anything. So that's a hoax. If you see that, you can tell people, actually, that doesn't really work. And somebody pointed out that actually really what Facebook really wants is your data, and they already have that. So that your photos and things are kind of superfluous because they have all of that information. And there's also a story that Twitter may be doing away, or at least expanding, its 140-character tweet limit. It's very early. Twitter says, "We are looking into maybe expanding our messages," very kind of cryptic language to see. No one knows if it's going to keep the 140 characters, if it's going to make people maybe have a premium subscription or something to do more characters, or if celebrities will have more characters. But that'll be interesting to see what happens with that.
Yeah, because that's always been part of Twitter, just 140 characters. That's it.
Yeah, so yeah. It could soon be more. We'll see.
All right. Well, thank you, Andrew. That's social media editor Andrew Palshevsky. This is VOA.
Here's Science in a Minute.
Mars is not the dry, arid planet that we thought of in the past. Today we're going to announce that under certain circumstances, liquid water has been found on Mars.
That was NASA's Jim Green. Using data from the Mars Reconnaissance Orbiter, scientists found clues of liquid water on the red planet in mysterious dark streaks flowing down the slopes of a number of hills, mountains, and craters.
Our findings strongly suggest that these recurring slope lineae are formed by liquid water on present-day Mars. The spectroscopic detection of hydrated perchlorates indicates that this water is briny and not pure.
Mary Beth Wilhelm of NASA's Ames Research Center says that water found on Mars could be an important resource for those who may someday explore or even perhaps colonize the red planet. I am VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
This is International Edition on the Voice of America. I'm Sarah Williams. Coming up, we'll hear how you can purchase a piece of Hollywood memorabilia. The senior-most U.S. intelligence official has said he remains skeptical a new U.S.-China cybersecurity agreement will slow the increasing and more sophisticated cyber attacks on U.S. public and private computer networks. The director of national intelligence, James Clapper, had this exchange Tuesday with Senator John McCain, chairman of the Senate Armed Services Committee.
As a result of the Chinese leader in Washington, there was some agreement announced between the United States and China. Do you believe that that will result in a elimination of Chinese cyber attacks?
Well, hope springs eternal. I think we will have to watch what their behavior is, and it will be incumbent on the intelligence community, I think, to portray to our policymakers what behavioral changes, if any, result from this agreement.
Are you optimistic?
No.
Later in the hearing, Clapper stopped short of accusing Beijing of leaving behind all such attacks emanating from China.
The extent to which Chinese purloining of our data, our intellectual property, is pretty pervasive. I think there's a question about the extent to which the government actually orchestrates all of it or not. So I think we're in the model, to borrow a President Reagan term, trust but verify mode, at least as far as intelligence is concerned, and we are inherently skeptics.
Clapper suggested economic sanctions may be the best way to force China to curb cyber attacks. At the same hearing Tuesday, Deputy Defense Secretary Robert Works says the agreement calls for at least twice yearly high-level meetings between the two countries.
This is going to be a high-level joint dialogue. The Chinese will have it at the ministerial level. Our U.S. Secretary of Homeland Security and the U.S. Attorney General will co-lead on our part. We're going to have the first meeting of this group by the end of this calendar year, and then at least twice a year. So I believe that, as Director Clapper is, I think all of us have some healthy skepticism about this. But I believe it's a good confidence-building measure and a good first step, and we will see if it leads to better behavior on the part of the Chinese.
University of Chicago China expert Dolly Yang told VOA's Victor Beatty, this issue is complicated, and the Chinese government will have a challenge to rein in rogue hackers in the country.
Well, my sense with those kind of issues, and given the bitter acrimony before the negotiations, before the agreement or understanding rather than a formal agreement in many ways, is that actually it's going to take a lot of effort on both sides in many ways of monitoring, of reaching out to the people who might actually be committing such acts. And in the Chinese case also, I think everyone recognizes that there are many players in China. This is a vast country, many people. Some are affiliated with state units. There are a lot of young people as well who are very interested in doing things as well. So my sense is it requires a lot of monitoring and also education on the part of the Chinese. So I would be looking for some indicators of what the Chinese government is doing. Are they going to be issuing some sort of guidelines or documents to people working in the software industry, for example, or who are writing codes to tell them that, yeah, there are certain actions that are simply not acceptable and so on. And, of course, there would need to be continuing dialogue and review of the situation over time. So in that sense, actually, a little bit of skepticism actually is warranted, whether it's technology or trade or many other issues.
I guess from your comment, that would imply that the Chinese government, in your view, is not responsible for all of these attacks.
Yeah, I think, I mean, just like in our country, in the United States, we also from time to time have wayward actions by individuals as well. So in that sense, actually, a government cannot be fully responsible for everything. But that doesn't mean that the Chinese government doesn't have any accountability, because, of course, the governments can do a lot more, including, for example, finding out who are the perpetrators and, of course, punishing those who do.
Mr. Clapper, in his testimony before the Senate on Tuesday, as well as other top U.S. military officials, said cyber threats are increasing in frequency, scale, sophistication, and severity, and the U.S. needed the same kind of deterrent capability in cyberspace that it maintains for nuclear weapons. Obviously, this is a serious problem that incorporates not just attacks from China, but other countries.
Yeah, I think this is a global issue. We have our industry, and in fact, it's not a single sector. It's a sector, a technology that has become so indispensable to our everyday lives and, of course, to the functions, the businesses of gigantic corporations and governments. So software and, of course, operating systems are everywhere. So in that sense, it's extremely important that there are systems globally to deal with those kind of issues, to provide some order, while, however, continuing to encourage innovation of experimentation around the world.
That's University of Chicago China expert Dolly Yang. Under the bilateral agreement announced last Friday during President Xi Jinping's state visit to Washington, President Obama said both countries affirm the principle that governments don't engage in cyber espionage for commercial gain against companies. Mr. Xi has called such cooperation mutually beneficial. This is VOA.
Hashtag VOA. It's a weekly show, Tuesdays at 1730 UTC, where we bring you the top topics of the week. But the show lives on social media every day with your daily video shorts, What's Trending Wednesday, and the Friday Fast Five. Subscribe to the show at YouTube. You can find us at hashtag VOA. You can reach me at Twitter, at Perry Cal, or talk to the show anytime. Please don't forget to like us on Facebook. We like to be liked. We love to be seen. And you can reach us anytime.
Hi, my name's Larry London. Welcome to Border Crossings, your request and dedication program here at the Voice of America. 1500 Universal, Monday through Friday, we're there for an hour playing your favorite music. You can send an email in and request your favorite songs by your favorite artist. You can also phone in as well. We have great contests and surprise guests from time to time. Border Crossings, every single day during the week at 1500 Universal, here on the Voice of America.
This is International Edition. If you've ever wanted to own a piece of Hollywood history, this week, now's your chance. Some prized artifacts from Star Wars, Star Trek, Raiders of the Lost Ark, and even an actual Academy Award are up for bid in Hollywood. International Edition's David Byrd has details.
If you've ever wanted to own a part of movie history, you can bid this week at Profiles in History in Calabasa, California. Items from some of Hollywood's biggest blockbusters, including the original 1977 version of Star Wars, are up for bid. Brian Chanis is the head of acquisition for the auction house.
We have your usual suspects, things coming ranging from Star Wars, Star Trek, Jaws. We have Quint's harpoon rifle from Jaws. One of the iconic barrels, his machete, and just things from all over movie history that people clamor towards.
Brian Chanis says other items up for sale include the golden slave bikini Carrie Fisher wore when she was a captive of Jabba the Hutt in Return of the Jedi. And her ship from the original Star Wars in 1977 is also on the block.
One of my favorite pieces actually came from Grant McCune, who won the Academy Award for visual effects in Star Wars. It's the very first spacecraft that you see in the opening sequence of the first Star Wars. And that one, we have an estimate of $200,000 to $300,000, but I suspect that it's going to be, you know, more in the maybe $500,000 range plus.
Indiana Jones's fedora and bullwhip and a motorcycle ridden by Daredevil Evel Knievel will also be sold. Brian Chanis says that Star Trek fans will have the chance to bid on original costumes worn by the late Leonard Nimoy as Spock in both the television show and in the Star Trek movies.
Original series, second season tunic, the velour one with all the braid, the insignia from Star Trek, the original series. Great documentation. We also have a costume of his from Star Trek, the motion picture, back in 1979 when he started doing the feature films. Then, of course, we also have his costume when he mind-melded with the humpback whale in Star Trek IV, The Voyage Home. So, we have things, covering his earlier years as Spock and also his later years.
Nimoy died February 27th at age 83. And if you've ever wanted your very own Academy Award, Brian Chanis says you have the chance to own a very rare one.
Only the third Best Actress Oscar ever presented. It was for Norma Shearer for the film The Divorcee from 1930. And, rarely do you see an Oscar of that caliber reach the auction block. It's one of the very first that was presented. It's got the Belgian marble base. They look a little bit different than the cylindrical bases of today's. But that one we have at $150,000 to $250,000.
Other items in the catalog include Russell Crowe's costume as Maximus in Gladiator, Angelina Jolie's custom wetsuit and gun rig from Lara Croft Tomb Raider, The Cradle of Life, and a complete Spartan costume, including helmet, shield, and leather girdle from The 300. Or you could bid on a full Spider-Man costume from Spider-Man 3. Music fans can bid on John Lennon's British Fireman's Coat, a Gibson Firebird guitar played and signed by Carlos Santana, or an authentic amulet charm made with Jimi Hendrix's hair. The auction runs through October 1st. I'm David Byrd in Washington.
The music of Jimi Hendrix. Well, that's our show. Please visit our website at voanews.com. I'm Sarah Williams. Thanks so much for joining us.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
The U.S. Trade and Development Agency awarded a grant on September 25th to NextGen Solawazi Limited to support the development of a 60-megawatt solar photovoltaic power plant in Shinyanga, a city in northwestern Tanzania. The grant supports a feasibility study that will evaluate the technical and commercial viability of the power plant, conduct environmental and social impact assessments, and provide the necessary analysis for NextGen Solawazi to seek implementation financing. This project is critically important to Tanzania's economic growth as, according to the World Bank, only 15% of its population has access to electricity. USTDA is pleased to continue our work with NextGen Solawazi to develop renewable energy in Tanzania, said Director Leocadia Zak, who signed the grant agreement along with NextGen Solawazi Limited Managing Director Mayank Bargava. This project presents a valuable opportunity to draw upon U.S. technical expertise to deploy new energy generation capacity in Shinyanga. Tanzania's National Strategy for Poverty Reduction and Growth has identified limited power generation capacity and poor electricity access as the most critical issue for development, said Mr. Bargava. Energy generation from the solar plant will not only electrify an estimated 210,000 households, but also act as a catalyst to attract other commercial enterprises by providing reliable, plentiful, and cheaper electricity. The feasibility study will be undertaken by U.S. engineering and technical consulting company Clean Energy Consulting and Education in Phoenix, Arizona. The project builds upon the agency's previous collaboration with NextGen Solawazi, including the provision of an owner's engineer who is supporting efforts to build a 5-megawatt solar plant in Kigoma, Tanzania. Both of these projects advance the goals of Power Africa, a U.S. government-led initiative to add cleaner, more efficient electricity generation capacity across the subcontinent. The United States is proud to work with its partner, Tanzania, to help provide clean, safe, and renewable energy to meet the needs of a growing and vibrant population.
That was an editorial.